I'd like to deal with Inyani Megillas Esther this evening and Inyani Purim next week. So if by some terrible misfortune you brought a Chumash Shemos, all is not lost, because Megillas Esther is at the back of all good editions of Chumash Shemos. We have been following with the Perush of the Yosef Lekach, taking one Perik a year, and we find ourselves, therefore, in Perik He, chapter 5. And as we will see, quite a bit to say. We begin, of course, by recapping briefly. We know the story, but just to place ourselves exactly, the Gezeira, the decree to exterminate the Jewish people, is out, has been disseminated. Mordechai has gotten wind of it and is confronted and challenged Esther to do something about it, which she indeed says that she will. She tells everyone they need to fast for 3 days, and so will she and her team. And that is exactly where we find ourselves on the Yom HaShlishi on day 3. And so let's follow the Psukim, and as we'll see, even and especially perhaps the Psukim that we're familiar with, to see the nuances and the details, and from that the texture and the fabric and the dimensions of the Megillah will emerge. So Pasuk Aleph reads, "Vayiba Yom HaShlishi." It was on the third day of this fast, which actually was the first day Pesach. They didn't have a Seder that year. We'd been making up for it, certainly in terms of Arba Kosos, ever since, but for that year. "Vatilbash Esther Malchus," the Pasuk reads. Esther clothed herself in royalty. And what does that mean, Vatilbash Esther Malchus? Of course, the pshat is that she dressed herself in royal finery. That is unquestionably the pshat. However, as is often the case, the drash persists, because the something about the specificity here, where it does not say Vatilbash Big Day Malchus, but rather Vatilbash Malchus, it sounds like she wore kingship itself. And what does that mean? And here we find the Gemara itself has addressed this question in Maseches Megillah. As we know, the first parak of Maseches Megillah has inbuilt a commentary from Chazal on Megillas Esther. And the Gemara raises the question. It doesn't say Vatilbash Big Day Malchus. What is Vatilbash Malchus? Says the Gemara, Lovsha Ruach HaKodesh. She clothed herself in Ruach HaKodesh, in divine spirit, divine inspiration. The Gemara quotes from elsewhere in the Tanakh that one can be clothed in a spirit, that the Ruach Lovsha Esamasa. And therefore, according to the Gemara, Vatilbash Malchus means that she clothed herself in Ruach HaKodesh. We may ask, what does she need Ruach HaKodesh for at a time like this? I mean, it's always good to have, but we make specific mention of it here. It seems that she needs other things. She needs charm. She needs grace. She needs good favor. Why Ruach HaKodesh? Perhaps we'll see. A very interesting accompanying perush, Vatilbash Esther Malchus, comes from the Sefer Iye Hayam. The Sefer Iye Hayam, which are actually words taken from Megillas Esther, if you recall, towards the very end, the Iye Hayam was written by Rabbi Yehuda Edel of Slonim. He is the author of the Droshes Afike Yehuda, classic Drush Sefer, and his Kedushi HaGodos are called Iye Hayam. And Iye Hayam explains that Malchus is a concept that expresses HaKadosh Baruch Hu's closeness with the Jewish people. As we find, the Pasuk says in Parshas Balak, we say it in Musaf on Rosh Hashanah, Utruas Melechbo, the friendship of the king is with the Jewish people. That's when they are at their best. And indeed, prior to this stage, sadly, but it's part of the story, the Jewish people had been somewhat distant from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They let themselves slide for whatever reason. And what had happened here was something of a return. These last 3 days have been a nationwide awakening through the fast and through tshuva, and they had reconnected with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And Hashem, of course, as always, Ani L'Dodi V'Dodi Li, reconnected with them. And the Iye Hayam says that, in fact, the greatest asset that with which Esther could approach Ahasuerus at this time was the collective connection of the Jewish people with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's what she clothed herself in. That's what she girded herself with. That is called Vatilbash Esther Malchus. Truas Melech, Hashem's reconnecting with the Jewish people, that's what empowered Esther at this time. And so, as the Pasuk continues, Vata'amod b'chatzabe samelech ha'pnimis, she stands in the courtyard, the inner courtyard of the palace, nochach b'samelech, opposite the palace, v'amelech yoshev ha'kiseh mechusa b'veisat malchus, and the king, he's sitting there on the throne, nochach pesach ha'bayis. So we have a great deal of positioning here, he's exactly where he needs to be, she's where she needs to be, and he sees her, as Pasuk Beis says. Vayihi, Chiros Hamelech es Esther Hamalka omedes bechatzer. When he sees her standing there, Nosachein beinav, so she found favor in his eyes. Vayoshet Hamelech leEsther es Shavit haZahav asher biyado. So he extended the scepter, which was the all-important sign that he wasn't going to kill her. Vatikrab Esther, vatigab rosh haShavit, and she approaches. She touches the head of the scepter. So the pasuk tells us that, and this is of course what Esther has been preparing for and hoping for, that when Ahasuerus sees her, she finds favor in his eyes. It's very interesting to note that the Pasuk emphasizes that she found favor in his eyes when she was standing in the courtyard. And by that we mean, Pasuk Aleph has already told us exactly where Esther is. Vatamod b'chatza beis hamelech. She is in the royal courtyard. Pasuk Beis reiterates, when the king saw her, omedes b'chatzer, standing in the courtyard. Why does the Pasuk repeat where she was standing? Presumably, she hasn't moved since Pasuk Aleph. However, says Yosef Lekach, the point is that she found favor in his eyes specifically when she was standing in the courtyard, as if to say she wasn't yet close enough for Ahasuerus to see how deathly pale she was and how worn out she was from the 3 days of fasting. In other words, as long as she's a certain distance away, he sees her, and he sees her form, and she's Esther, but when he sees up close, actually, he begins to worry. And that is why, dafka when she's omedes bechatzer nasachem be'inav, but as she comes close, pasuk gimel, vayomer lahamelech, so he always talks to her in twos. What's this and what's this? He says, malach Esther amalka, uma bakoshaseich, ad chatzia malchus v'inosein lach. Now, what are these two questions in Pasuk Gimel? We always understand what would you like and what's your request, but those sound like two ways of saying the same thing. Later on, he will say, Masha Ela Seich, Uma Bakosha Seich, in a few Pesukim's time. What's your question? What's your request? Here, his opening question to Esther is not, what is your request? Malach means, what is with you? As if to say, what's the matter with you? Is everything okay? Because she didn't look her best. Because she's been fasting for 3 days. And when people fast for 3 days, they don't look their best. And as we mentioned last year in the previous parak, this was a very important strategic decision for Esther. Because on the one hand, she has to balance her endeavors and her investments both in tshuva, but also in terms of her relationship with Ahasuerus. And at a certain point, the two clash. Because the more she engages in tshuva, the less, perhaps, glowing she is. And that would seem to compromise her chances of success with Ahasuerus, which are all important. And yet we see that Esther unequivocally gives priority to her tshuva involvements, which, apart from anything else, entail fasting for 3 days, even though that means that she will need all the more divine assistance in order to find favor in Ahasuerus' eyes. But so be it. The alternative to back away from tshuva in the interests of finding favor in Ahasuerus' eyes, Esther sees that very clearly as counterproductive. But it is a major decision on Esther's part. I mean, she goes there knowing that she's, the way the Gemara describes it and the Medrash describes it, she could barely stand up by that stage. She had to be supported, either the Medrash says by two of her maidens, or by the Gemara says by two malachim, and she's not at her shiniest. Although interestingly, and it is true that the fast was called for 3 days, But there is a Masorah that Esther, she broke the fast just a couple of hours before she went to Achashverosh. In other words, that she shouldn't just go there and collapse in a heap at his feet. She did break the fast just a couple of hours before. Everyone else fasted for 3 days. She fasted for 3 days minus 2 hours. Says Maharal, that was her concession. Says Maharal, where do we see this? Because when she tells at the end of Perek Dalet that everyone should fast for 3 days, Tzumu alai, Shloshi Samim, Al Tuchlu, Al Tishlu, Laila Vayom, she says, Gamani v'narosai otzum kein, I and my girls will fast similarly, uvechein, and thus I will come to the king. Says Maharal, if you look at the words kein and uvechein, you will note that the word kein has the gematria of 70. Kaf is 20, nun is 50. 3 days, total 72 hours. Esther says, we will fast, but not the whole thing. We need those final 2 hours. Gamani v'narosai osum kein. Me and my girls will fast for kein. We'll fast for 70 of those 72 hours. But you'll be fasting the whole thing. Uvechein, v'chein, the added base, is 72. With your 72, avo el hamelech. That's a very interesting remez from Maharal in the Sefer Or Chadash, which is his perush on Megillas Esther. Okay. But certainly Esther, she's in. And she's found favor with the king, and he wants to know what he can do for her. Interestingly, and parenthetically, there's a well-known statement of the Gemara with regards to Chatzi HaMalchus. That's quite a grandiose thing to say, which is not surprising, because Achashverosh is a grandiose person. But to say, I will give you up to half the kingdom, I mean, what is he expecting? I mean, maybe she just wants who knows what. Well, where does Chatzi HaMalchus come in? And it could be an expression, but the Gemara says he is referring to the Beis HaMikdash, which had begun to be constructed, but then construction was halted, and that lay at Chatzi HaMalchus, the halfway point of the Malchus, as if to say, Achashverosh says you can have anything except the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash, which I believe it's a well-known statement of the Gemara. But it's very interesting to ponder why Achashverosh would think that Esther would be wanting such a thing, especially as is key within the story, he has no inkling that she's Jewish. As far as he's concerned, she comes from just whoever. And if there's one thing that he wants, it's amazing that even though Achashverosh doesn't think that Esther is Jewish, but he constantly has on his mind, no one can ask for the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. It's such a seemingly random thing to bring in. Ironically, as a result of the Purim story, the construction was restarted, but Achashverosh was not to know that. But that's just an observation with regards to that comment of the Gemara. But what does she want? Well, Esther doesn't say. What Esther does say in Pasuk Dalet, Vatomer Esther imal hamelech tov, if the king thinks it's a good idea, and because the party is coming, of course the king thinks it's a good idea, Yavo hamelech v'haman hayom el mishteh asher asisido. I'd like the king to come to a feast. And at this stage, it is worthwhile asking a basic question. Namely, Esther's in. She has the king's attention. Her goal is not to have a feast. Her goal is to save the Jewish people. She has an opportunity now. He is asking her, what would you like? Why is it that Esther forgoes the opportunity to lay her request at this time, but rather goes through a process first with one feast and then the second? But even a first feast, why not just ask straight out? Well, says Yosef Lekach, there are a couple of considerations. Firstly, as much as Esther has, as she's found favor in the king's eyes, but she's not in a secure position at the moment. As if to say, exceptionally, the king has allowed her in, etc. But she needs to develop, in a sense, as if to say, if she uses this small amount of favor to then lay on a feast which could lead to a greater amount of favor, then will be the correct time to ask for repealing the king's edict. She doesn't feel that she has enough credit, shall we say, grace credit, in order to ask for that right now. She needs to just establish herself, be secure that the king should be more and more expansive towards her, and then ask. And the truth is, and here the Malbim echoes really the theme of the Yosef Lekach, because this is no simple request. And when you think about it, this is what we celebrate, at least in terms of the story, every year. The major miracle was that the king's edict was repealed. When you think about it, all that should involve is the king changing his mind. People change their mind the whole time. But the reason why it was such a big miracle is because for Esther to get the king to change his mind was a very big thing indeed. Because, as we know, Ahasuerus is extremely sensitive to people, certainly his wives, telling him to do the opposite of what he's done already. In other words, the background to all of this is, as we mentioned back in Perek Beis, is that he's still scarred by his experiences with Vashti, who undermined him and defied him, etc. And therefore, any notion that Esther perhaps is getting Vashti-like ideas, and she also wants to countermand him in some way, could lead to a very bad reaction. And that's why the first thing that Esther needs to do is, in a sense, to show that she's with him, that she only has his interests at heart. And therefore, if he asks, what would you like? The answer is to make a feast for you. So that it should be clear that whether anything she's doing is not to counter him in any way, but rather she only her interests are aligned with his. That's the first point. Secondly, says Yosef Lekach, no one likes to be told bad news. But certainly no one likes to be told bad news when they're enjoying themselves at a party. And therefore, Esther is choosing the moment to reveal that Haman is really working against Ahasuerus, the time where that will provoke the greatest or the harshest response from Ahasuerus against Haman is when they're all having a good time. Because that means not only is Haman countering the king, Haman is ruining the party. And for Ahasuerus, that itself is a terrible crime. So she's looking to build things up so that the whole thing will burst and it will be Haman's fault. And eino dome, bad news when it comes in the office, to bad news when it comes in the middle of a feast. Thirdly, and interestingly, and this is itself a very sensitive issue, Esther is married to Ahasuerus. His expectation presumably is that if she's come to him, so it will involve matters of physical intimacy, which Esther is not really interested in. But how can she approach him and then refuse? It's very difficult, unless she has a feast ready, in which case they don't have time for anything other than to go to the feast straight away. And that's why she says, interestingly, if you look closely at the pasuk, she prepared the feast before she came to Ahasuerus. So there wasn't even any time. The feast is ready. We're late. I mean, fashionably late, but we don't want to be later. She says, Yavo ha-melech v'haman hayom, ela mishteh asher asisi lo. I've made a feast for the king. The food's getting cold. I mean, we should really get going. And when the wife tells the husband that we're late, well, that means it's time to get going. So these are the parshanut of the Yosef Lekach as to what was behind Esther's thinking that her first request should be to move things to a feast setting. Okay. But there is an accompanying question. And that is, okay, that's why she has a feast with Ahasuerus. But why invite Haman? What's the thinking behind including Haman in this feast? And this question, famously, is asked by the Gemara itself. And part of what makes the question famous is that the Gemara provides no less than 12 answers to this question. And although it's the Megillah, we will not be looking to say all 12 in one breath. We'll take them one by one. This is in Maseches Megillah, again, Daf Tesvav, Amud Beis, Tan Rabbanan. The rabbis taught, Ma'ra'asa Esther, Shezimna is Haman. What's she inviting Haman for? I mean, he's the enemy. You want to have a feast with Ahasuerus for all the above reasons. But why is Haman involved? First two, answer number one, Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Pachim Tomna Lo. She set a trap for Haman. And what is the meaning of setting a trap for Haman? that Mefarshim explain, she is looking to lull Haman into complete sense of security. His guard will be down, he'll think everything's amazing, and that's when he'll be most vulnerable. That's the first thing, or that's according to Rabbi Eliezer, what she hoped to achieve by inviting him to the... He'll be absolutely there, and without any defenses or even any notion that he needs to defend himself, as far as he's concerned, things couldn't be better. Rabbi Yeshua Omer, Mi Beis Aviyah Lamda. She learned a tradition from her forebears. Shene Emar, quotes the Pasuk in Mishlei, Imra'ev sonacha hachilehu lechem. If your enemy is hungry, feed him bread. And what is the meaning of that pasuk? Well, it could mean many things. But again, Mefarshim explain, it's confounding for the enemy when he's the recipient of kindness. The lines are blurred. It's a little bit confusing. His enemy is there, but she's feeding him, and he's not exactly sure where he stands. And she wants to put him into that indecisive mode, and therefore she feeds him. Rabbi Meir Omer, number three, Kidei Shelo Yitel Eitza V'Yimrod. She doesn't want Haman in a place that he can then begin some type of counter-offensive. She wants him there, out of circulation. There's no one he can take counsel with. There's no one that he can plot and plan in terms of his escape. She wants to isolate him. Number four, Rabbi Huda Omer, Kidei Shelo Yakiru Bashehi Yehudis. This is a very interesting explanation that it's critically important, as we know, and it's amazing, really. It's its own miracle that Ahasuerus, until this point, never found out that Esther was Jewish. But of course, once he starts thinking, and what could it be, and maybe she wants to keep any notion of her Jewish identity secret until the moment. There's no better way to do that than to be in league with Haman. If Haman's on the guest list, the last thing that anyone will think, oh, she's probably Jewish. And that was part of the thinking there. Number five, even more intriguing, Rabbi Nechemia Omer. Kidei shelo yomu Yisrael achos lanu bebeis hamelech v'yasichu data min harachamim. This, I think, is the big chiddush. Rabbi Nechemia says, answer number five, is that she didn't want the Jewish people to feel, now that Esther's in, we can let up on our tshuva and on our davening. They need to be davening right until the last minute, and even beyond that. And therefore, she almost gave the Jewish people like cause for alarm. They were a little bit puzzled. Why is she writing Haman? I don't know if we're out of the woods yet. It's important that they should not feel out of the woods, and therefore she even kept the Jewish people guessing. Ad kedei kach. Rabbi Yossi Omer, number six, Kidei Shehei Matsuila Bechol Eis. She wants Haman there the whole time, because as long as Haman is there, it's possible that he will do something that will cause him to lose favor in the king's eyes and further worsen his position. And those possibilities are always there as long as he's present. Number seven, Rabbi Shimon ben Menasya Omer. Esther says, it's such a desperate thing to invite your enemy to a feast. Perhaps when Hashem sees how desperate I am, he will have all the more mercy and do a miracle for us. I mean, this is absolutely beyond what one could possibly expect. It's a sign of desperation. But if Hashem sees how desperate we are, he'll have rachmanus. Rabbi Shua ben Korcha Omer, number eight, Azbir lo ponim kidei sheyehareg hu vehi. Rabbi Shua ben Korcha says that she was prepared, if necessary, to have herself be killed along with Haman. That is to say, that if it looked like Ahasuerus was taking Haman's side, Haman would be there, she'd begin to make eyes at Haman, so that Ahasuerus, paranoid that he was anyway, would think that they were consorting one with the other, kill them both. She was prepared to have herself killed if Haman would be killed, if that would help repeal the decree. Number nine, Rabbi Gamliel Omer, Melech Hafach Pechan Haya. Ahasuerus, as we know, very changeable, very fickle. He could change his mind really, by the time you could say Ahasuerus, you could change his mind again. And therefore, he didn't want there to be any distance between his decision and being able to implement it. It could be that when he says, well, Haman should be killed, and by the time they go to fetch Haman, and then it takes time, and then he's not ready, and then the king gets distracted, and she didn't want there to be any time lag between his decision and its implementation. Rabbi Elazar HaModoi Omer, Kinos Melech, Kinos Basarim. She's looking to arouse Achashverosh's jealousy of Haman. Not so much in terms of a relationship with Esther, but why is she bringing Haman into the feast? And also she's looking to alienate Haman from the other Sarim, because it's quite well known that of all the Sarim, as Haman himself will brag quite soon, she only invited Haman. She's looking to cause bad feeling between Haman and everyone else, so that no one should come to help him. They'll feel that he deserves it and serves him right, because he was the only one that she invited. Final two. Thus far, the first 10 have been from Tanoim, and the final two are from Amoraim. Rabba says, quotes a pasuk in Mishlei, Lifnei Shever Gaon, which is a well-known expression, but it's from Mishlei. Pride comes before a fall. She's looking to build him up. The higher he goes, the harder he'll fall. And Abaya and Rava both say, and that's also nice that they're both in league here, Abaya and Rava, Bechumam Ashis es Mishtehen, that's a pasuk in Yirmiyah, which says that at a time of a meal, that's the time when people are most open to things that otherwise they would not be. And once again, she wants Haman to be there and Ahasuerus to be there. That all the decisions were made will be decisive. Well, 12 answers to one question. That's quite a result. And someone in the Gemara was interested in knowing which was the real answer here. So the Gemara concludes, Ashkechei Rabba Bar Avua le'Eliyahu. So Rabba Bar Avua, so he found Eliyahu Anavi, and he had to ask him, Amarle Keman Chazia Esther va'Avda Hachi. Which one was it like? I've heard 12 answers, and which one was it? Amarle Eliyahu says, Kekuluhu Tanai uKekuluhu Amarai. Like all of the explanations given in Tanaim, and all explanations given in Amarai, Esther's thinking encompassed all 12. And I think perhaps it was such a multifaceted initiative to bring Haman in, and she has her eye on all of these ideas. Perhaps we can then understand why the Gemara says Vatilbash Esther Malchus, that she had Ruach HaKodesh. I think to simultaneously have in mind all these, what each of the Tanaim is working, each one independently, to discover one of them, and she's incorporated all of them, I mean, that's Ruach HaKodesh. And indeed, although, as is well known, Hashem's name is not mentioned explicitly in the Megillah, but it is alluded to, and the place where it's alluded to is actually here when Esther issues her invitation. For if we look again at Pasuk Dalet, she says, Yavo Hamelech v'Haman Hayo, let the king and Haman come today. If you look at the Rosh Tevos, the first letters of those four words, Yavo Hamelech v'Haman Hayom, you have Yud and Hey and Vav and Hey, which is the Shem Hashem. And Rabbi Nebachia says, because here we see that she's possessed of this divine spirit in order to issue this invitation. Okay, now, so they come to the feast. Pasuk Hey, Vayomer Melech Maharuas Haman, Hari Haman. A lot of the story of the Esther takes place over a long period of time. Between the first two chapters are 9 years. But when everything's in place and things start moving, they move very quickly. From this point onwards, it's hari hari. Vayoma melech maharu es Haman. You've got to rush Haman. I mean, if I'm rushing, Haman's certainly got to rush. La'asos es devar Esther. And the king and Haman come to the first feast. Okay, so they're there. Pasuk Vav. Vayomer HaMelech le'Esther b'mishteh hayayin. So he says, okay, we're all here. Ma she'la seich b'inaselach. What's your question? It'll be given to you. Ma bakash seich. What's your request? Ad chatzi ha'malchus v'se'as. And here, as you mentioned before, Achashverosh is talking about Esther's She'ela and her Bakasha. Ma She'ela Seich, Uma Bakasha Seich. And the question is, how are those things different? Presumably, when you request something, you ask for it. When you ask for something, you're requesting it. What is She'ela and what is Bakasha? There's a well-known comment of the Vilna Gaon here, and that is that as a rule, She'ela is when a person is asking for something for themselves. Bakasha is when they're asking for something for others. And that is why we find that Achashverosh here says, Ma She'ela Seich, what is your She'ela? V'nasein lach, it will be given to you, because your She'ela is for you. Alternatively, you may have a bakasha. You may be requesting something on someone else's behalf, in which case, v'se'as, it will be done. He doesn't say your bakasha will be given to you. A bakasha is not for you. It's for others, but it will be done. And indeed, later on, when Esther finally, and we're not going to get to it this evening, but it's all there in the Megillah, in the second feast, when she finally says what it is, her words are, t'nosein li nafshi b'she'elasi, Va'ami b'bakasha si. You ask, what's my she'ela, what's my bakasha? My soul is my she'ela, and my nation is my bakasha, because her soul is herself, and her nation is others. That is the well-known comment of the Vilna Gaon. But it is worthwhile pointing out, as the Malbim does, that this distinction of she'ela is for oneself, and bakasha is for others. But we should go back to Pasuk Gimel, and see back to when Esther first met with Achashverosh in the palace before the feast, because Achashverosh says in Pasuk Gimel, "Vayomer laHamelach, Malach Esther Malka, like we said, was with you. Uma bakasha seich ad chatzia malchus v'yinasein lach. What is your bakasha? Even half the kingdom, it will be given to you." So this is very interesting, because in the earlier pasuk, at that first meeting, Achashverosh says, "Whatever your bakasha is, it will be given to you." But that's rather intriguing in light of what the Vilna Gaon says, a bakasha is for others. But here Achashverosh says your bakasha will be given to you. But it's also interesting that Achashverosh himself changes. If we pay close attention here, because in Pasuk Gimel he says your bakasha will be given to you, but then three psukim later at the feast he says your she'ela will be given to you and your bakasha will be done. So, leaving everything else aside, what's behind Achashverosh's use of terminology here? And that's why the Malbim heads in a different direction. And Malbim says, the difference, which is the important question, what is the difference between She'ela and Bakasha? She'ela, says the Malbim, is when you're asking for something relatively minor. Bakasha is relatively more significant. And we see even in the words, because she'ela can also mean to ask in the sense of to inquire. No one's doing anything special for you. You're just asking. You're just interested. And therefore, something which doesn't have such a big gesture involved, that's called she'ela. A bigger thing is bakasha. And in fact, what Yosef Lekach says, that Esther is looking to move Achashverosh into a more and more generous mood, you see it in the psukim. Because originally in Pasuk Gimel, when they first meet, Achashverosh says, what's your bakasha? It will be given to you. Meaning, Achashverosh is at that stage only interested in helping Esther. He doesn't talk about helping anyone else. He doesn't take into account she may be asking for others. If it's for you, even if it's a big thing, I'll do it. But only for you. Ma bakasha seich, bina seinach. And we can certainly therefore understand why Esther can't ask what she really wants, because she wants for others. She wants for her nation. Achashverosh isn't ready. It isn't until the first feast that we see that Achashverosh is becoming more open-hearted. And he talks about whatever will be done to her, it's already become a she'ela. Anything for you is a small thing. Ma she'ela seich v'nasenach. We've moved on. We've grown. And moreover, if you ask for it, a bakasha, it will be done, even if it's not for you. Achashverosh is finally expressing his willingness to do something. It might be a big thing, but he'll do it anyway. For you, it's a small thing, because that's already established. But for others, he's prepared to do it. And therefore, the climate is readying itself for what Esther wants, but it's not completely ready yet. And that's why Esther asks for another feast. Now here, of course, we just dealt with the first feast, but then, you know, mitzvah gereres mitzvah. How come the first feast, she asked for the second feast? What's behind moving it to a second feast? And at this point, Esther is in a very delicate situation. Having established the Ahasuerus's security, she then proceeds to make him a little bit insecure. Firstly, the very fact that she's not forthcoming with her request. Either she asked him to come to a party and he's come, and he said he'll do anything, and she's still holding out. That itself, it just increases the tension, which is, of course, very important. By the time it happens, Ahasuerus is about to explode. But secondly, she begins to sow seeds of suspicion between Ahasuerus and Haman. The invitation to the first feast is not like the invitation of the second. If you look at the psukim, you'll see the first feast says in Pasuk Gimel, let the king and Haman come, El Amishte Asher Asisi Lo, to the feast that I have made for him. The first feast is made for Ahasuerus. Haman is the guest of honor, but it's the feast for Ahasuerus. But in Pasuk Ches, she says, Yavo HaMelech HaHaman El HaMishter Asher E'eseh Lohem. I will be making a feast for them, meaning for you, the two of you, for Ahasuerus and for Haman. And that struck a bit of a not such a good chord with Ahasuerus. And that's why it's really such a delicate balance here with Esther, because she needs, on the one hand, the king's good will, but she needs to already develop bad will against Haman. And therefore, feast one was for the king. Feast two is for both of you. And Haman's like, why is it for him also? I don't mind if he's here, maybe, but why is the feast for him? And Haman also picks up on this. We see later on in the psukim when he's bragging to his family and his friends, he says, his words are, Aflo hevia Esther. Esther only brought me to the first feast. V'gam lamochar ani karu lo. And tomorrow I'm called to her. Interesting how he changes the nouns. The first feast, he says, hevia, see. She brought me there. She invited me there. But tomorrow ani karu lo. I'm a bigger deal in tomorrow's feast. She's not just bringing me again. It's for me. And there's a certain irony here, which the Malbim mentions, and that is that Haman got to... he has no idea. No one has any idea what these feasts are about. Not Ahasuerus, but you have to wonder what's Haman thinking. Why does he think that he's invited to these feasts? He doesn't know. It's a bit of a mystery for him. I don't know if he's ever spoken to Esther before, and all of a sudden, it's the king, him, and Esther. And he's there at this feast. And that's when he first discovers that Esther wants something and the king doesn't know what it is. That much he's worked out. And then, tomorrow, that's when all will be revealed. And Haman's invited. Why is Haman invited tomorrow also? So Haman began to think that perhaps Esther needs his help. Whatever it is, why is he there? Only the king can grant her request. But why does she want Haman there? Maybe she needs Haman in order for the king to grant her request. So he is absolutely defenseless by the time he comes in. He thinks the world of himself because apparently Esther needs me for something. I don't know what it is. I'm happy to help, perhaps. But that's the way that he goes to the second feast. Well, that has yet to happen. And a lot will happen in between. But in the meanwhile, Pasuk Tes. Haman is in a good mood for approximately 3 minutes. Vayetze Haman bayomahu. So Haman comes out, sameach v'tov lev. He's on top of the world. He's happy. And then he sees Mordechai. And he's not happy anymore. V'chiros Haman es Mordechai b'shar ha-melech. And he sees Mordechai. Mordechai sits there b'shar ha-melech. V'lo kam v'lo zami menu. Mordechai doesn't stand up for him. He doesn't move. And those two terms are important because one of them is, shall we say, religious, but one of them is personal. And Mordechai, there's nothing like Mordechai to make Haman feel absolutely worthless. He doesn't stand up for him because there's issues there, Avodah Zarah, etc. Haman has his idol, whatever it may be. But you can acknowledge him. Mordechai doesn't move. That's personal. And as Chazal have mentioned, as long as Mordechai remains seated, there is something which is highly visible, the sole of Mordechai's shoe, upon which is written that Haman is actually the slave of Mordechai. The Medrash gives us the background. They were both at one point in the king's army. They're given rations. Haman, true to form, eats through everything in record speed. He has no food left. He comes to Mordechai, begs him to feed him. So Mordechai says, I'll feed you if you sell yourself to me as an eved. And Haman agrees, but you need a pen and paper. You need a document. There's no pen. There's no paper. So they wrote it, however they wrote it, they etched it maybe, on the sole of Mordechai's shoe. And that gives an added element to Mordechai not moving, because as long as he sits there and the sole of his shoe is visible, it kind of takes the geschmack out of everyone bowing down to Haman, because it's clearly visible that, and then why would Mordechai bow down to him? He's his servant. Mordechai's getting nachas that everyone's bowing down to his servant. He doesn't need to join in. And Haman just, he gets filled with anger again. Vayumale Haman al Mordechai. And it's so clear that it's a personal thing here, and he's just full of anger with Mordechai. But he doesn't want to do anything. He gets himself under control and goes home. Implying, incidentally, that if he hadn't gotten himself under control, he wouldn't have gone home. But where would he have gone? Well, perhaps had he lost control, he would have gone back to the feast while he thinks that everyone's in a good mood and asked him to kill Mordechai. But he doesn't feel that that's appropriate, as we've already seen, and it's amazing, but it's mefurish in the pasuk, that although it's a personal thing between Haman and Mordechai, Haman feels that it's beneath him to kill a personal enemy. That's beneath him. He'd rather kill the entire people, but he doesn't want to make it personal. That was to show that he's been baited by an individual. So he gets himself under control and goes home. And who does he meet with? He meets with his wife, and his friends, or actually mentions his friends first. Vayishlach, he calls Vayaveyas Ohavav Ves Zeresh Ishto. And this is our first meeting with Zeresh, by the way. She has all sorts of interesting advice for Haman. It tends to change from time to time, but she's his partner there. We say Aru Haman, we say Arura Zeresh. Yeah. Interestingly, I've never been anywhere where they bang or make noise when Zeresh's name is mentioned. I'm not sure why. After all, in the interest of equality, she deserves equal drowning out. Just a suggestion. But in any event, so she calls them, and he begins to put his situation to them. And says, and he begins with how amazing everything is, or was, until very recently. How wealthy he is, how many children he has, which they must know already. But the point base, the king has raised him up so high. And not only the king, but also Esther. She didn't bring anyone else except for me. As we saw, Hevia and Karula, Mishte 1, Mishte 2. So it's all amazing. And that's part of the reason why he doesn't wish to belittle himself by having this personal run-in with Mordechai. It's interesting, just to note in passing, but all these things, they add up, they give us the picture. He describes the first feast, Ela Mishte Asher Asasa Ki Imosi. Now the word is should be Asasa, like Asasa Mishte. But he puts it as asasa. That's normally the sort of thing that happens when you get to the end of a phrase or a pasuk. It's called the pausal form, asasa. But we're not at the end of a phrase. But Haman, as the Megillah describes his words, puts a kamot there. What's that all about? Well, we recall from time to time the very fascinating comment of the Rabbi Nebachya in Parshas Vayera, who explains that the nekudos, in addition to telling you how to pronounce the word, also give you the character of the word. He quotes the Sefer HaBahir, which tells us that the relationship between the letter and the vowels is like the guf and the neshama. The vowels are like the neshama. They're the personality. They're the character of the word. And specifically, Rabbeinu Bachya talks about the difference between a patach and a komatz. There's something about a komatz. It has a certain element of chashivus, of significance. Visually, it's elevated. It's on a stand. It's on a pedestal. The komatz is somewhat more elevated. And that is why, says Rabbeinu Bachya, a patach word will change to a komatz when it comes at the end of a phrase or sentence. Kena'an will become Kena'an, and so on and so forth. Why? Because coming at the end of a phrase or the end of a sentence adds to its chashivos. It's the final word, and therefore that added chashivos is represented. It's almost like promoted, or we would say upgraded, from a patach to a komatz. It's very interesting to see how what seem to be pure issues of pronunciation are actually characterization. Komatz word is a heftza. And sometimes, as Rabbeinu Bachya, you'll find that it doesn't even go together with the rules of grammar. When the pasuk is emphasizing how great something is, it might give it a komatz, even though it's not a pure pausal form. And that, of course, fits perfectly with what Haman says. Because Haman, as far as he's concerned, this feast is the greatest thing that ever happened. And it is only natural, therefore, in his words, that when the way he will describe it, there'll be as many komatzes in that word as possible, and forget about grammar. And that's why he expresses it as elamishta asher ososa. It's a choshev asuda. It's a komatzdik asuda. Okay. But none of this is of any meaning to me. None of this is any value to me. Pasuk Yud Gimel, the Chozeh, Einenu Shoveli, means nothing to me. B'choleis asher aniwes, Mordechai Yehudi Yoshe B'shar HaMelech. That's his position. And his wife has advice for him. But it's interesting that's a kind of a condition. He has everything except for one thing. And if he doesn't have that one thing, he feels like he doesn't have anything. I mean, that's a Haman syndrome. And interestingly, and this I heard from my father, Zichron Lebracha, the Gemara, as we know, in the end of Maseches Chulin, it looks to find references or allusions to all of the people in the significant people in the Megillah, to find them in the Chumash. Esther, it has to Aster, and Mordechai. And what about Haman? Haman min haTorah minayin. Where's Haman to be found? So he's found in the Eitz Hadas. Hamin ha'Eitz, Hashem says. Hamin ha'Eitz, Asher tzivisicha. Is it from the tree I told you not to eat, you ate? Hamin, says the Gemara, Haman. This is amazing. And clearly needs to be understood. When the Eitz Hadas is unpopular enough as it is, and it just got Haman in it. But my father explained, quoting Mefarshim, as far as I remember, the Eitz Hadas is exactly the same as Haman. Adam had everything except for one thing. He has free reign of the whole garden, and all the other trees are good for him, and he can take from whichever he wants. There's only one tree that's off limits, and he stands in front of that tree and just can't take it. And that's really that's a certain attitude. And the Gemara says, but Haman did the same thing. He has everything except for one thing, and he feels like he has nothing. Where does that come from? It's like the Eitz Hadas. And the point is to warn us. And it's interesting, as we go back to our Ramazim of Hashem's name, Yavo HaMelech V'Haman HaYom Yud Kei Vav Kei, there's another time that Hashem's name is alluded to, and here it's in Haman's words. And it's backwards. In Haman's words, when he said, this is like the most godless thing that a person can think. He says, in Pasuk Yud Gimel, the Chozeh Einenu Shoveli, none of this means anything to me. If you look at the end, the Sofei Teves, Zeh Einenu Shoveli, Hei Vav Hei Yud. That's the Shem Hashem backwards. And says Rabbeinu Bachya in a number of places, Parshas Noach and Bamidbar and Shalach and elsewhere, that if the Shem Hashem is the name of mercy, but then the name backwards is a reversal of all of that. Hashem has given him everything, and the whole thing is reversed and undone. And that's Haman, and he's miserable. He has everything except for one thing, and he's miserable. And interestingly, his family sympathize with him. I guess that's where they're married. Because his wife gives him advice, as opposed to telling him just to grow up. And Pasuk Yudalet, Vatomer lo, Zeresh ishto v'chol avav. Interestingly, his wife, who seemingly has become first now, and all his families, they're in league. They're in accordance. They're in agreement. What did they say? Yasu eitz gavoa chamishim ama, make a gallows, 50 amas tall, 50 cubits tall, ubaboka in the morning, emor lamelech vislus Mordechai alav, tell the king, and they'll hang Mordechai. Now, we need to understand, how is this the answer to anything? He's miserable, and they say, make a gallows, in the morning tell the king, and he'll hang Mordechai. I mean, how is that addressing his concerns? Well, the Yosef Lekach explains that the first thing they say to Haman is, you cannot go back to the feast like this. As much as whatever's happened with Mordechai, it's eating away at you, but you've got to deal with it before you go back to the feast, because if you turn up at that feast the way you turned up at home, it's not going to work out well for you. If your issue is Mordechai, so make a gallows 50 amas tall, you'll be able to see him from where you are. That's the point. It was visible from where Haman would be. It will make you happy, and you got to be happy. You got to put your mishteh face back on before you go back to the second feast. And with regards to, it's embarrassing for you, or it's demeaning for you to be calling for the revenge against one individual person. So that's what they said. So go early. Ubaboka, that's the Eitzah, go in the morning. No one else will be there. Don't wait for the whole entourage to be there. Don't wait for the whole court to fill up and everyone will hear the Haman has an issue with one specific person. Go early, no one will be there. Do Hashkama and ask Achashverosh there. That's how the Yosef Lekach explains. But interestingly, the Malbim is somewhat different. According to the Malbim, Zeresh and his friends, they're looking to find a way that he can get revenge against Mordechai, but it doesn't look personal. That's, for him, it's demeaning. Vayivez be'enav, as we saw. Here's what you can do. Everyone is told to bow down to you, and Mordechai isn't doing it. I mean, and they're told by the king. It's the king's edict until further notice. That means that Mordechai is defying the king. Don't ask the king to kill Mordechai because you're upset with him. Tell him to hang the king as an example for anyone who defies the laws of the king. And that's why the gallows should be so tall, highly visible, as a lesson for everyone in obedience to the king. And say it in the morning, everyone will see it when they leave home, they'll go and they see Mordechai will be hanging there, and make it into a king's message, that he'll do your work for you. That's how Malbim explains. And Haman liked the idea. As the pasuk says, "Vayita v'adavar lefnei Haman, v'yaso eitz." He thought it was a great idea. He made the gallows. He made the tree. Now we note, by the way, no one ever told him to make it. Their advice was, "Yasu eitz chamishim." Let them make it. Who? Workers, construction workers. Who says that Haman needs to make it? Haman feels he needs to make it. A gallows. 50 cubits high. It's a lot of work. If one may say it, it's a tall order. you can get other people to do this. I mean, Haman has money. We see here the intensity. For Haman, it's not a labor of love, it's a labor of hate. But sinume kalkeres es ashura, he doesn't even ask anyone else. He doesn't even want to make a shaliach. He'll do it himself. And this midrashim, where did he get a wood that was so tall? The only place that was so tall was his own house. He knocked his own house down to take the central beam. That's the gallows. I don't think Zeresh and his friends had that in mind. But he did it himself, just to see. Haman, what is he doing for the rest of that day? He's building a gallows. It takes time. As far as he's concerned, it's a good day. And moreover, he goes to Achashverosh extra early. And what is the follow-on, really, into the next parak, is that everything from this point that Haman is doing it only serves to work against him. That gallows that he built that was so tall so that it could be visible, the visibility of the gallows ended up being his undoing. Because as we know, when the times of second feast came and he is unmasked and he is exposed as the enemy, but things could still go either way and Ahasuerus doesn't know what to do. Ahasuerus, amazingly, when he gets angry, he goes out to cool off. Which means he himself finally seems to be learning that maybe when he's angry is not the time to make important decisions. It took a long time to happen, but seemingly he wants to cool off. But when he comes back and things are getting worse, and Chavrona pipes up, and Chavrona says, here's the gallows that Haman made to kill Mordechai. In the interim, Mordechai has become the king's best friend. Balaila Hahu has happened in the meanwhile. Haman spent the beginning of that day parading Mordechai around as a person that the king wishes to honor. And now the gallows are painfully visible that Haman wishes to hang Mordechai. Very awkwardly, Haman had forgotten to dismantle the gallows before. He didn't have a chance. Vayavhilu. Everything's hurry. And therefore, he literally prepared all of that work, went into those gallows being visible, and Chavona says those are the gallows, and that point it was all over. The king says, you've got to hang them on him. But also the issue of timing, because Zerah says, go in the morning. And Haman couldn't even wait until the morning. I mean, he's there pacing up and down outside the palace. It's the middle of the night. And that itself, his rizus, his energy and his eagerness to be first got him there so early, he was ultimately on location when the king couldn't sleep, and who's Bechatzer, and it's Haman. What's Haman doing there? It's so early. It's the middle of the night. It's not even daybreak. He doesn't even want to wait till Boker, but that put him on location. So then he got sucked in and drawn in, and what malasos ba'ishish ha'melech ha'feitz b'karo, and he thinks it's him, but it's really not him. It leads to Mordechai, and therefore all of his energies. That's really the deeper understanding of v'nafochu. Is that it's not just that he did certain things, but then the counter things happened. The very things were reversed. All of his construction and all of his energies were all ultimately reversed upon him, unfolds in later prokim. Ken yovdu kolavecha Hashem. We'll leave it over there for the time being, and meet again, Mitzvah Hashem, next week to discuss in Yonei Purim.